Our next guest wrote for ESPN, the magazine, for 8 years. Her work has appeared in publications like Baseball Prospectus, the New York Times Magazine, and more. And she's got a tremendous new book out chronicling the Los Angeles Dodgers over the last few years. It's called The Best Team Money Can Buy, the Los Angeles Dodgers' Wild Struggle to Build a Baseball Powerhouse. Molly Knight, welcome to Downtown.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The book is absolutely fantastic. I just got it a couple of days ago and have not been able to put it down. It's so good. And what's remarkable about the book, a number of things, but the access that you were able to get, and that's important on a couple of levels. And one, you allude to in the dedication of the book when you mention all the women who fought to be allowed to report from locker rooms. Without them, it would not exist. Can you talk about how you got that access and what a difference it made in the story you're telling?
Yeah, sure. So I covered baseball for ESPN for a long time. So through that, I was admitted to the Baseball Writers of America Association, which basically means I get a pass, like a little pass to wear around my neck to go into any locker room. But as far as getting these guys to open up, I mean, it took a long time to earn trust. And I think part of it had to do with the fact that I was there reporting on the McCourts and their divorce, the people that owned the team before this new group came in. And they knew I was down at the courthouse every day, and they would ask me, like, are our checks going to bounce this week and that kind of thing. So it became like less of a like a reporter player interaction, more of just like peers kind of trading information. And then also, like I said about the peer thing, I'm the same age as these guys, so I mean I'm kind of right in the middle of them right now. So I think part of it is just like, you know, I befriended wives and girlfriends and you know families and hung out and was just around and sort of like they just told me stuff, I guess.
Well, a part of that access too is revealed right in the prologue to the book, and a remarkable set of circumstances and things occurring at the same time that you were with Clayton Kershaw when he got the call from his agent about his big contract extension.
Yeah, that was crazy. It just happened to be the day that we had set up our interview. I mean, obviously, I saw him every day in the locker room, but I got most of these guys for our formal interviews away from the field because there's just not enough time. Obviously, they're preparing for games. So that was the day we settled on, and I flew to Dallas and went to his house for our interview, and we sat down at his kitchen table, just the two of us, and he got a phone call from his agent, and he said, "Congratulations, Clayton, the deal is done," about 3 minutes into our interview. And I was just sitting there. It was just the two of us. His wife had gone out to do some errands. And, I mean, he knew the deal was almost done because he had taken physicals the day before, so his wife knew, and his mom knew, and, you know, some of his friends knew. But I didn't know. And I was just sitting there like, okay, and you know, the rest of the world didn't know. And I asked him, like, do you want me to leave? Like, do you need to, like, call people? And he's like, no, it's okay. Let's do the interview. So that was pretty surreal, actually, his focus in that moment.
Well, of course, here in the Northeast, we're focused on the Red Sox, but this book is a great read for Red Sox fans on so many levels. First of all, I'm even more grateful than ever after reading your book that Frank McCourt was not able to get his hands on the Red Sox when he tried to do that.
Oh, aren't you? I mean, the curse would still exist. They would not be, you know, three-time champions in recent memory right now.
Well, one of my favorite stories in the book involves the big trade with the Dodgers and the Red Sox. Can you tell some of that story of Stan Kasten being in the right place at the right time and then using one of the owners, Mark Walter, to distract some media people while he met with John Henry?
Yeah, so basically when these new owners came in, they had to rebuild the team very quickly, and they didn't want to go into sort of the mode where they were willing to sacrifice talent on the big league level to rebuild the farm system, because both were in disarray, the major league team and the farm system. So they wanted to get stars right away, and they made a list of players, like in a perfect world, forget about contracts, how much they're owed, and if they just signed or whatever, like who would we want? And Adrian Gonzalez was at the top of their list because he played first base and he could hit for power, and their first baseman, James Loney, could not. He was a great defender and a great guy, but he couldn't hit home runs. And he was a Mexican American, and that's huge. The Dodgers fan base has a huge Hispanic and Latino component, and they love it. They love cheering on fans that come from the same heritage. So he was at the top of their list. They tried to trade for him before the deadline. I think they were only willing to take on, it was either Beckett or Crawford. It was just one of them. and they thought they had a deal. I mean, it's a package with Gonzalez. They thought they had a deal, but it fell through on the day of the trade deadline, I think because the feeling was that Boston was still sort of in the hunt at that point. And then the Red Sox came after the deadline, and they were just atrocious. And then the owners had a meeting. We have a semi-annual owners meetings where we all get together, and they were in Denver, the Four Seasons. And it was actually the day that that report leaked on Yahoo, written by my friend Jeff Passan, about how Gonzalez had texted John Henry to try to get Bobby Valentine fired, that whole mess. And so it was like actually perfect timing. So I think at that point the Red Sox were playing poorly. This thing had come out, so they were kind of tired of Gonzalez. I know a lot of his teammates were over him, and Henry was probably just like, yeah, I'm ready to blow it up. And Dan Kasten saw him on the patio having cigars with Jerry Reinsdorf, the White Sox owner. And Mark Walter said, I'm still not over it. I want Gonzalez. Go try to see what you can do. And so he pulled Henry off the patio. But the problem was, or he went out to the patio, but the problem was there were a couple of national reporters standing in the bar, and they would have seen the whole thing, right? They would have seen Dan Kasten pull John Henry off the patio, and they would have sniffed it out. So they developed a sort of a ruse. They sent Mark Walter, Kasten sent Mark Walter over to talk to the reporters, and Kasten offered, said, hey, you guys want to sit down with our new Dodgers owner? And at that point, no one had really had a sit down with him yet. So they was like, sure, great. So they positioned the reporters with their back to the room. And again, Walter sat down with them, started talking, and then Kasten ran out and grabbed Henry. And they went, I think, up to a suite or somewhere, and they did the deal in like 10 minutes.
We're talking with Molly Knight. The book is The Best Team Money Can Buy. Mark Walter, the Guggenheim Group, when they made that purchase of the Dodgers, everybody gasped at the price, but they used some interesting math to try and figure out what the team was worth. And based on TV contracts, they felt at the time, and I guess still feel like they got a bargain.
Oh, yeah, and they did. I mean, the Houston Astros have been the team that sold right before they were about to make their bid, and they sold to Jim Crane and his group. Or I believe $680 million. I think they got a little bit of a discount on that later when MLB forced them to move to the American League. But the sale price was $680 million. So Mark Walter looked at the size of the Houston market, and then he compared that to the size of the L.A. market in terms of households and televisions, and he realized, well, the Dodgers are the L.A. market is three times that of the Houston market. So just on the media rights deal alone, the Dodgers are worth three times what the Astros are worth. When you factor in all the land and Chavez Ravine surrounding the stadium and the fact that the Dodgers sell out, I mean, they lead attendance every year in baseball, except for when that year that McCourt was in bankruptcy. They thought, wow, this team is worth a lot of money. So they bid, they spent $2.15 billion, and then 18 months later they got a television contract for over $8 billion for 25 years. So it was a pretty good deal. They're pretty happy with it.
Molly, you devote a whole chapter to the interesting person that is Yasiel Puig, a Puigatory, you call it, mm-hmm. and you describe him, if I remember right, as the Hollywood child star of baseball. What do you mean by that?
Well, it was such a weird situation, right? The Guggenheim Group buys the team for $2 billion. They get all these stars. They trade for Gonzalez and Hanley Ramirez and Carl Crawford, and they sign Zach Greinke, and they're supposed to go win a World Series, right? Well, in June of that year, they're in last place, and they're atrocious because of injuries and poor play and just general malaise. And they had no intention of promoting Puig that year. He had just defected from Cuba. He was 21 years old, 22 years old, and he was emotionally much younger than that, and he needed some seasoning in the minors. But they sort of were forced to, because this is a new ownership group that had spent all that money, and they didn't want to languish in last place. So they called him up probably before he was ready. And nobody, even when he had been good in spring training, nobody expected him to come out and be the best player in baseball that first month. And he was. He had the best rookie month of anyone since Joe DiMaggio. So it was insane. And unfortunately what happened was he didn't get the proper rookie training and grooming that most rookies get, where you're showed the ropes by the veterans, and you're told how to behave, and you're kind of guided along and brought along like a freshman in high school would be on a team with a bunch of seniors. Like, he took over as like the freshman. He was the man, and they were all looking to him to save their season. So the players who don't like him now, they will acknowledge that they were part of the problem by putting everything on him. He was so young, and now it's like it's really hard to get him to correct some of those behaviors.
I've seen you say that of all the players on this team, Zach Greinke may be your favorite. He's having such a remarkable year. What is it about Zach that you can relate to?
I just think what I love about Zach is that he's so different, and I think a lot of people can relate to, maybe not as extreme as Greinke, but a lot of people can relate to not feeling like they fit in, or just feeling uncomfortable in groups, or just feeling kind of different. And he felt so strongly that way after he was drafted. But even though he's a blue-chip prospect, this was a guy who quit baseball because of social anxiety disorder. And he got it together. He went and got help. He's been open about that. He didn't talk about it too often, but he went and dealt with it and came back and, you know, won the Cy Young. And now he's just the best pitcher. He and King Clayton Kershaw are the two best pitchers on the planet right now. And I love that he's so smart and he's honest. You can ask him, most baseball players, most athletes talking cliches. You ask Zach Greinke, and he'll give you a straight answer. And like the other day, it was funny, he was pitching to Yasmani Grandal, and Grandal took a ball off the chin, and his backup AJ Ellis came in, and AJ walked out to the mound and said, "Hey, Zach, you know, what's the plan here? What are we doing?" And he's like, "Well, all four of my pitches are pretty awesome right now, so I'm not worried about it." You know, like, he'll just say stuff like that. But he'll also say when he's not good, he'll say, "I'm not very good today," or, you know, I should need to come out of the game or whatever. He's just honest.
So is this the year for the Dodgers?
They got to get Cole Hamels. They got to get Cole Hamels or maybe Johnny Cueto. Their pitching is very thin. They lost Hyunjin Ryu and Brandon McCarthy, two devastating injuries. And they've got Greinke and Kershaw, but after that's a bit dicey. I wouldn't trust Mike Bolsinger in a playoff game, even if he's able to hold it together today against the somewhat weak Atlanta Braves offense. I think they're going to go there. I think they'll go get Hamels. I really do. They need to stop messing around. They've got the prospects. They've got the money to pay for free agents in the offseason, but Hamels is too good to pass up, and I don't think it's going to cost. I think the price on him is coming down. I think Amaro wanted Corey Seager, who's currently the top-ranked prospect in the minors, and Julio Urias, who's also in the top 10 pitcher. But I think that he's calmed down and come back to earth, and he'll take a package of lesser prospects to get this done.
The best team money can buy, the Los Angeles Dodgers' wild struggle to build a baseball powerhouse. Absolutely. One of the best baseball books I've ever read. Molly, it's a tremendous read. Thanks so much for being with us. My only regret is that I didn't get a book plate from you.
Oh, my gosh. Well, thank you so much for having me. And I've been to Maine a lot, and I love it up there. I go to Portland whenever I can. I've lived in New York for a while. It's one of my favorite places on earth. So maybe one day I'll make it up to Bangor.
There. Perfect. Absolutely. Not perfect. Bad for
That's
an Angelina.
I've been saying it. So good.
Thank you, Molly. God, continued success with the book, and thanks for coming on with us.
Thank you so much for your kind words.
That's Molly Knight. It is a fantastic book. The